evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Crotty in Washington, D.C.
And so we are saying government should, number one, compensate these people, those that lost loved ones, those that were injured, and those that lost property for this negligence.
The minority leader in Uganda's parliament calls for immediate compensation for the families of victims in the landfill tragedy.
Now, Chadema has requested the police to immediately release these people and asked President Samia to form a judicial commission of inquiry to inquire as to whereabouts of this abduction that has been taking place in Tanzania.
Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, demands a judicial inquiry into the arrests and disappearance of its supporters.
So for them to come and create an impression as if we're never organizing, we don't know what we're doing. Well, I think the response is in reverse. They don't know what they're dealing with.
And South Africa's opposition MK party plans to impeach President Cyril Ramaphosa. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Uganda, the minority leader in parliament is calling for immediate compensation for the families of those who lost their lives in the recent landfill tragedy. Joel Senyonyi says there's evidence of negligence that shows top officials of Kampala and the government led to the tragedy. This after a mountain of rubbish at the landfill collapsed, killing at least 34 and left 28 people missing. The tragedy led to calls for accountability, including demands for the resignation of top officials among the authorities in the nation's capital city. Parliamentarian Joel Senyonyi tells me that he is demanding the government produce a comprehensive waste management measure to ensure future accidents are averted.
What happened is very tragic, but incidentally, it was seen coming because there were correspondences within KCCA, that's the city authority, from the department in charge of health and so on to the higher authorities weeks before this happened, letting them know that, look, this landfill is giving way. It is potentially going to be a disaster which could even kill people. Those letters have been circulating, which were shared with the higher authorities, but nothing was done. And so because they saw this coming, we think this was absolute negligence. And so we are saying government should, number one, compensate these people, those that lost loved ones, those that were injured, and those that lost property for this negligence. If that does not happen, we are certainly taking them to court because this is utter negligence. In fact, we would have expected those concerned, the officials concerned, to resign because by not doing their job, people have died. Dozens of people have died under a garbage heap. This is totally unacceptable.
Some people are also calling for their prosecution if they fail to resign or somebody to be held accountable. Is that your stance too?
Yeah, we are saying somebody has got to be held accountable because, like I was saying, there was communication, there was information that this landfill was going to crumble, it was going to give way, and it would cause a disaster which would potentially cause loss of life. Those were the junior, you know, those were letters written by the junior officials within KCCA, writing to their seniors, alerting them about this issue. But nothing was done. So that negligence there cannot be left to go unchecked. And that's why we are saying, before heads could even be made to roll, people should have resigned, should take responsibility for this. So we are pursuing that matter. But we are saying, as that gets to happen, these people must be compensated by government because government and KCCA were negligent.
Moving forward, I've heard some people talk about the fact that there appear to be no comprehensive waste management plan to prevent similar incidents happening in the future. What is your take?
The sad thing is that many things really operate on the go. And we have challenged government to say, in 2024, surely, waste should not be such a big problem. We should have a proper waste management plan to be able to recycle waste, to be able to metamorphose it from garbage to energy, because, you know, garbage can be of such value if we are properly set for it and we get to do that. So that's something we are challenging government on, that people should not be crying about waste being a problem. In some countries, waste is seen as gold. So it depends on how one gets to plan. And so we are telling government, plan.
What about the issue of concerns being expressed that the initial response was not that great, and that if there has been prompt response, many lives could have been saved.
Absolutely. You know, many times when disasters like these get to happen, government is slow at moving, at operating. Right now, they even called off temporarily, I'm told, the search operation, but 28 people are still missing. Now, what do you tell to these families who are saying, look, our loved ones were staying here, now they are nowhere, and you're saying, we have halted this? That's the sloppy modus operandi of government. They many times don't move quickly. I saw on that day the disaster, when the disaster did happen, the locals got their hose, rudimentary equipment, and they were trying to do this work. Police came and stopped them, saying, our tractors are coming. And you see, the tractors took forever. And these people were saying, in the meantime, let's try and salvage what we can salvage. So that sloppy modus operandi really is what aggravates situations.
There are demands that the government present Parliament its detailed plan about what to do or how to deal with waste management in major cities in Uganda, especially Kampala. Where do you stand on that?
That's something we are pressing government about, and we are insisting that they come through on that issue in Parliament. We must have a waste management plan, because what they are doing now is looking for other landfill places. But we're telling them that's temporary also, because before long, those places will also be fully, you know, occupied to capacity by garbage, and then we might have another disaster. So we must have a proper waste management plan, as opposed to just looking for another site, dump garbage there, it gets full, you look for another. That's not sustainable in this day and age.
Joel Senyonyi is the minority leader in Uganda's parliament. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Tanzania, the head of the legal affairs of the opposition, Chadema, is calling on President Samia Suluhu Hassan to demonstrate the political will to establish a judicial inquiry over the arrest, murder, and disappearance of citizens. John Malia says Chadema would decide its next line of action if the president refuses to acquiesce to the party's demand for a judicial inquiry. This after Chadema accused the security services of targeted violence, abductions, torture, and disappearance of citizens, including supporters of the party. It also demands the immediate release of all members recently arrested by the police. The police have denied the allegations as without merit. Supporters of the government say the police are only doing their job by enforcing the law. But John Malia tells me that the opposition party demands justice for those whose constitutional rights are being violated.
It's paramount to understand, Peter, that recently there have been abductions and irregular arrests of Chadema supporters, but also normal civilians and Tanzanians who question the government on issues pertaining not necessarily to politics, but to general human rights and thought. Now, the Tanganyika Law Society has recently given a list of 83 Tanzanians who were recently abducted and or arrested by the police, and they were about are not known. But more recently, three Chadema members were kidnapped by people which Chadema believe is the government apparatus. Maybe the police or the national intelligence are holding these people without stating the whereabouts and why they're not talking to court or any other legal entity where issues that they're claiming will be dealt with. Now, Chadema has requested the police to immediately release these people, and has asked President Samia to form a judicial commission of inquiry to inquire as to whereabouts of this abduction that has been taking place in Tanzania. That is what Chadema basically demanded.
Do you think the demands of Chadema are realistic?
They are realistic. It's not the first time a commission of inquiry has been formed. During Kikwete's era in 2008, I suppose, President Kikwete formed a commission of inquiry after three businessmen from Morogoro region were abducted in Dar es Salaam by the police, and their properties were confiscated illegally. And these police were later on aligned in court, charged with murder. So this is realistic demand. It's achievable. It only requires presidential will and readiness to do justice to the Tanzanians.
But the police have denied these allegations of arrest and torture and abduction of supporters of Chadema. How do you respond to that?
They always deny. It's not the first time. Just recently, a Chadema member was abducted in Tanga region for a month. His relatives have been looking in all police stations, and they said, we don't have this person. 1 month later, police spokesperson in Tanga confirmed that they had this person for the past 29 days. So they normally deny like this, but whenever things come to light, they'll apologize or give lame excuses and so on.
So why is Chadema pushing for the repeal of Section 4, Subsection 3 of the Tanzania Intelligence and Security Service Amendment Act of 2023? Why? Isn't this made purposely to protect life and property and the territorial integrity of Tanzania?
For obvious reasons, the law enforcement organ that has the power to arrest, investigate, and align people into court is the police. And we know when somebody is arrested, it's either this police station or the other one. The National Intelligence Agency in Tanzania, their office is a big secret. They don't disclose that where their office are. They don't have the police station to hold these people. This section empowers them to arrest, and it doesn't say when they arrest people, where do they take them. This is where all these abductions are hidden. They are doing the abduction behind the section. That's, we are saying this law has to be repealed because the National Intelligence has a duty to conduct its intelligence services, not to arrest people. The power of arrest should remain in the hands of police, who have been doing it at times legally, at times arbitrarily. But what we're saying is that these people have given so much power and they are concealing so much information that they arrest people and they don't say where these people are and what process they're taking in processing their justice. That is what Chadema is complaining.
If the government does not constitute a judicial commission of inquiry to investigate these abductions that Chadema is alleging, then what happens?
Okay, Chadema is a political party. You can take political actions or you can take legal actions. For me as a lawyer, I will only advise that you go to court and see if we can make this the court repeal this law or ask the whereabouts of all the people that are abducted. But Chadema can do other actions. He can make a national demonstration. It can take it as a political agenda and deal with it politically. So there are plenty of options to do, but for the time being, the demands have been put in place. We believe that the president will be prudent enough to meet the demands, and that's it.
John Malia is the head of the legal affairs of the opposition Chadema. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. In Kenya, a Gen Z protester is calling on President William Ruto to name young people to his cabinet. Robert Mwangi says it appears the president did not get the message the protests sent to the nation. His remarks come after President William Ruto said his decision to include opposition members in his cabinet is vital for the country's unity. The president also assured that his cabinet will deliver. But Robert Mwangi tells me that he remains unconvinced by the president's confidence if there are no new faces, including youth, to help administer the affairs of the country.
My reaction is, we'll just wait and see, because he's a president who likes giving promises, and also he thinks that he has done the country a favor by bringing in the opposition, but we know that he's killing democracy, because a democracy without a watchdog is not a democracy anymore.
The president said he is very confident that because of their experience, they are going to perform for the people of Kenya, basically underscoring the importance of the message he got from Gen Z protesters like you. What is your take?
Actually, we were asking for people who can deliver, but now the problem is he has brought the same people who have been in the government. You understand? And these people, some of them even have graft cases going on. They are of questionable behavior. So that's why we are not buying what he's saying. Just recycling the same leaders who have actually brought Kenya to the same predicament. So him saying that they are going to bring change, I don't believe you can teach an old dog new tricks.
But he's of the opinion that bringing these opposition ODM members into his cabinet is crucial, or was crucial, for the country's unity.
The country wasn't divided. Let's start from there. It wasn't divided. The only thing that the Gen Zs have brought or they are asking is for good governance. They are not there to divide the country. Remember, Kenya is a country that over the time, the politics has been dictated by tribalism. But Gen Zs have come and they've said they are not advocating for a tribe. They are one tribe and they're advocating for their country. So him bringing in opposition and saying that he's uniting the country was already united. So I don't understand how he's using that narrative to push that agenda.
Gen Z protesters asked for members of cabinet who would deliver. And he's promising that these people are going to deliver. Why wouldn't you just give him the benefit of the doubt?
The benefit of a doubt comes when you bring people qualified for such positions. These people are not qualified for such positions. Remember, last time I told you that the president is rewarding people who are brought in by the opposition leader, who is Raila Odinga. So he's rewarding Raila Odinga through these people. So there's no way that you can say that he has brought people who are qualified, yet qualifications come from the papers that they are presenting. These people, the papers that they presented, they are not qualified for those positions.
Well, he said Kenya is in an exceptional situation which necessitates putting aside personal or political interest. Basically saying people who he put in place to help him run the affairs of the country are selfless and who will put the interest of Kenyans, including the Gen Zs, above their personal interest. Some people say this is a welcoming development and should be applauded.
Not really. If he really wanted to put the country's interest, he would have brought Gen Zs. Because remember, Gen Zs are people who are qualified. They've gone to school and they actually went to education during Kibaki's time when there was free education. But right now what we are seeing, the module that we are having even for financing universities in Kenya, that is undergraduate courses in Kenya, it's not even working. That means universities or colleges in Kenya are closing down. So really we can't say that he's working on this module or bringing in these people is going to help Gen Zs. He needs to include them in these positions because they are qualified. They are qualified for these jobs.
Are you off in the qualification that you're talking about, are you also referencing the issue of experience? Because experience is key when you are in government institutions or an official of a government institution. Without experience, it's very difficult for them to entrust a responsibility in your hands, some of his supporters are saying.
The problem that we have with experience is that the moment you put experience now, it becomes politics. That is pure politics. And that's why he's bringing in politicians other than people who are qualified for these positions. Those are two different things. So the moment that he said that he's bringing in experience, he's only bringing in old people, recycling old people, recycling old politicians who have been there, who did nothing for Kenya other than stealing and looting money left, right, and center. So we can't really say that he's bringing in experience. Gen Zs, they are qualified and they are people of integrity, and I believe they should be involved or included in this dialogue or in these positions.
Robert Mwangi is a Gen Z protester. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In South Africa, the national spokesperson of the opposition in Nkonto with Sizwe or MK party says Floyd Shivambu brings a wealth of experience to boost the group's efforts to hold the African National Congress or ANC accountable to the public. Lamulu Ndlela also sharply denies allegations that the MK party lacks direction and structures to effectively play its role as the main opposition. His comments come after the deputy president of the Economic Freedom Fighters, EFF, Floyd Shivambu, resigned to join the MK party. Analysts say his resignation from the EFF appears to have destabilized the party. MK spokesperson Lamulu Ndlela tells me that South Africans should expect the main opposition party to continue its quest to impeach President Cyril Ramaphosa.
Here's what's important. EFF and MK are part of a progressive caucus. So Comrade Floyd joining us only bolsters our leadership capabilities and strengths from an official opposition perspective. Because as we've always said, we're going to be driving our programs inside and outside of parliament. And his onboarding can only strengthen our position. It doesn't in any way, referring to a coup, it's not a coup in any way. Remember, the Bill of Rights in this country allow for any citizen to campaign, associate, or even vote for whatever political party they so wish. And that's what has happened here. Comrade Floyd Bell felt that, you know, Mkhonto West is a home for him, and that he would be able to play a key role in a revolution. And he's made that decision, and hence he's now part of the leadership.
What really does he bring to the table for the MK party?
Look, he's got a vast experience, a lot of lessons learned from having been the co-founder of the EFF. And that's a wealth of experience that, if you look at it, not many people have, in terms of how do you start a party from the ground up and form the structures to operationalize and professionalize an organization as they did with the EFF. So that insight and that experience will certainly go a long way for us, especially at the point that we're at of forming a party and setting up the structures.
What is the true picture in Parliament of the MK party? Because some people are saying the MK party appears to be disorganized after choosing members of Parliament only to fire them.
You know, if anyone that's, I've heard this comment of us being disorganized and not having any structure. I mean, and it's coming from multiple political parties and naysayers. You know, what's sad, in actual fact, those that say that should be embarrassed, because in effect what that means is that they were beaten hands down by a five-month-old party that never had any structures. That says a lot, doesn't it? So for them to come and create an impression as if we were never organizing, we don't know what we're doing, well, I think the response is in reverse. They don't know what they're dealing with. The issue of the 18 members in Parliament that were replaced, these are members that we had communicated with them prior to them being sworn in. On the day, we said to them that here's a decision that was taken by the party, and with that, it's either you can get sworn in, which Parliament allows, and then be replaced at a later stage, or just not be sworn in, you know, from the onset. But the majority of them got an opportunity, and I guess they were opportunistic in their way, to then believe and decide to be sworn in, knowing very well that at some point we're going to replace. Remember, we had an issue leading up to the elections with our candidate list where, you know, we always say there's compromise, there's sabotage, because people were putting friends, family, neighbors, girlfriends, you know, partners on our list. Comrades that we had trusted. We actually even had to go and open up a case at the Sandton police station. The case number is there. It's a pending case.
Some of the critics are also saying that it appears that the MK party is run according to the whims and caprices of former President Jacob Zuma. And that is why the party appears disorganized. And that is where the criticism is coming from. What's your response to that?
But again, I go back to the same response. I mean, you're talking here about a galactical of politics. You know, you're talking about the godfather of politics. So this initiative of Mkhonto West Sizwe is one of the most successful stories ever, unheard of globally, you know, what has transpired here. And that comes with the brainchild of the same person we're speaking about, the former President Zuma.
What should be the expectations of South Africans of the MK party in Parliament?
Well, I can tell you now, we are going to, one, ensure that Cyril Ramaphosa is impeached. And we're going to ensure that we hold this so-called GNU, which doesn't exist, because even the opposition have said it themselves, that there is no so-called government of national unity. Cyril has taken the black vote and given it to a white racist party. And what we're going to do is to hold them accountable to service delivery. That's why we're bringing in the kind of skills that we has said are going to be sworn in and expected that they'll be happening this week in a form of former CEOs of strategic state-owned entities. So we are there to, in effect, ensure that we represent our people, black, white, Indian, or colored, any South African that wants to see change, and that is patriotic to the cause, and that's what we're going to do.
Klamulu Ndlela is the national spokesperson of the opposition Mkhonto West Sizwe, or MK party. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. In Ghana, the Africans Rising Movement is holding the second edition of a three-day meeting of all the Africa Movement Assembly, which begins on August 29th and ends on the 31st in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. It is the largest Pan-African conference of activists, human rights defenders, social justice advocates, and various movements. Organizers say that the second edition will build on the first one held in 2022, bringing together 400 participants to connect and strategize. Issues to be discussed, including the elimination of borders within Africa, climate, gender and economic justice, ethical governance, the expansion of civic space, and reparations. For more information about the conference, I reach Hardy Yakubu, is the Africans Rising Movement coordinator.
We are having participants from all across Africa and in parts of the diaspora. At least one person is coming from each of the African countries. So it's very representative. And this is the second edition of the All African Movements Assembly that is convened by Africans Rising.
What is the core reason behind this conference?
Well, it's basically to create a platform for African young people, especially activists, human rights defenders, and social movements to gather, connect, strategize, and collectively build Pan-African solidarity. We are in a, as you know, in a moment of crisis, multiple crises crisscrossing with each other, and it is a really momentous period that has the potential for a great leap forward or a disastrous retrogression, especially for Africa, which has been for the past centuries been a source of resources for the world's industrial development.
What specific crisis?
Which development has not really inured to the benefit of the Africans themselves.
Hadi, what specific crisis are you referring to?
I'm referring to multiple conflicts, skyrocketing cost of living crisis. I'm referring to many African economies now being indebted to different multilateral and individual creditors, for which reason taxes are being slapped on African citizens here and there. I'm talking about geopolitical happenings that create tension and that have created an environment for serious maneuvering on the geopolitical space. Where is Africa's position on all of this? And how do we ensure that we come out of this as a continent and as a people who have agency and be able to chart the course of our own destiny, especially critical for young people in the continent? Or are we going to come out of this crisis once again as suppliers of raw materials, drawers of water and hewers of wood? Energy crisis is pushing many nations to come to Africa for renewable energy resources and things like that.
Now,
all of these
the issues
come together to create a very a tense moment, both geopolitically but also continentally.
After the discussions and recommendations are made, what happens next?
Well, I mean, what we are coming to do is not merely discussions. I think it's a whole lot more. We are beginning the first day by touring the slave castles in Cape Coast and Elmina. These were places that our forefathers and foremothers were held for months before being shipped off to the Americas and Europe. So that gives us a reflective perspective in beginning to dispassionately
talk about the history, the present, and the future. On the last day, we're doing something that we call reimagining, you know, the future of Africa. And young people would have a platform to together just throw in imagination, you know, so that we are not just fighting for something that we do not like. We are also fighting for something. We are also creating something that we want to be in its place. So that particular activity is probably the mainstay of the assembly. And coming out of the assembly would be organizing frameworks and mobilization frameworks on various issues like the borderless Africa, a framework for Pan-African solidarity, and all of that.
Hardy Yakubu is the Africans Rising Movement coordinator. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Namibia's Minister of Agriculture has urged farmers in the southern African country to look at alternative markets for its charcoal and beef products, since the European Union, one of its largest trading partners, has implemented non-tariff barriers that came into force in 2023. For VOA, Vitalio Angula reports from the Namibian capital, Windhoek.
The unilateral decision by the European Union to impose regulations on agricultural products from Namibia that come from areas that have been deforested has raised concerns regarding market access for products such as beef and charcoal. These products will no longer have access to the European market unless they comply with the new rules that Namibian Minister of Agriculture, Kale Schleidwein, describes as stringent and prohibitive.
If you want to conduct agriculture, you have to clear the land. We have charcoal industry. We have a number of industries in the agricultural sector where we do have impact on deforestation. I said that farmers must be careful that if they do that, they must do that in compliance with these regulations.
The chairperson of the Namibia Biomass Industry Group, which represents over 150 members in the sector, Colin Lindeke, says the European Union deforestation regulation will not negatively impact exports to the EU. He said the EU is only asking for additional information. It wants geographic location tags that show that the charcoal they are exporting does not come from areas that have been deforested, but rather areas that are regarded as savanna, an argument with which Schladwein disagrees. Lindeke told VOA the regulations are fair and the members of the biomass industry group are compliant and meet the new EU requirements.
There was a consultant here recently from the EU looking at EUDR, and they specifically said that Namibia's bush encroachment is definitely not a forest in their opinion. But one of the challenges is our government hasn't made the distinction, and that's actually the bigger point of interest, because we in the current Forest Act of 2001 do not even define what a forest is.
Director of Forestry at Namibia's Ministry of Environment, Johnson Dokosho, says the ambiguities in the country's law regarding what is considered a forest, woodlands, and savannas are being dealt with in the new Forestry Act, which is being revised. He cautioned that Namibia is at the mercy of the EU when it comes to whether Namibia's beef and charcoal will still be able to enter their market.
If they found that maybe this beef is coming out of an area where deforestation is occurring, then they might actually affect our export.
Last year, Namibia exported 270,000 tons of charcoal worth $72 million, mainly to South Africa, which then exports it to other markets, including Europe. Europe is the top destination of Namibia's beef, with the Union consuming about 80% of the country's total exports, valued roughly at $23.5 million. Namibia is not the only country affected by the new EU regulations. Other countries include Brazil, Cameroon, and Nigeria. Products that are affected by the new EU regulations include cocoa, soy, palm oil, and coffee. Vitalio Angula, VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
The This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, the Security Council continued its discussion about ceasefire in Gaza, since its resolution that had called for ceasefire had not been fully implemented. And President Biden, in his last farewell speech before the Democratic Convention in Chicago, reaffirmed his commitment to ceasefire in Gaza and said that his Secretary of State, Blinken, had gone to the area to pursue the call for ceasefire and then to exchange the abductees. In that same convention, the last day, the Vice President Kamala Harris was responding to the endorsement by the convention of herself as the candidate of the Democrats for the election against Mr. Trump. She seized the opportunity to also call for a ceasefire and then expanded by calling for observance of the pain of the Palestinians in Gaza. She said she hoped that a ceasefire would lead to peace and also end in the Palestinian people exercising their rights of self-determination. When Secretary of State Blinken met with Prime Minister Netanyahu, he then announced that the Israeli government had endorsed the call for ceasefire. That was challenged by the leadership of Hamas. Nevertheless, the talks continue in Cairo and Doha. And yesterday, it was announced that the delegation of Hamas, which had refused to participate, said they would go to Cairo to be nearby, but they would not participate. Many, many people and governments have become very, very frustrated. The bombing of Gaza has been very ceaseless. And there is no indication that Prime Minister Netanyahu has moved away from its policy of maximum military pressure in Gaza. There is fear that if it continues, there is all likelihood of a wider war in the Middle East. It is important to pose the question, what is the end game for Prime Minister Netanyahu? Is he prepared to take a risk for peace? He believes that his plan, which may be a diktat, should be the full defeat of Hamas. It is also puzzling that Prime Minister Netanyahu is calling on Egypt to accept what would amount to a violation of the state of the Camp David agreement. Israel's troops remaining in the Philadelphia corridor. Of course, this would be extremely difficult for the Egyptian government to accept. So this is a sticking point. I think the time has come for many people, Israelis and others, to remind Prime Minister Netanyahu that the only reason why Camp David Treaty was signed is because President Anwar Sadat decided to take a risk for peace. He knew that his decision to go to Jerusalem would be opposed by many, but he took the risk, even though he lost some of his ministers. He took a risk to ask the military delegation of Egypt to meet with that of Israel in Kilometer 101, knowing full well this would outrage the Arab world. But he took the risk. He also decided to invite the Israeli Prime Minister Begin to the Egyptian soil in Ismailia, knowing full well this would not be acceptable to the Egyptian people. But he took the risk for peace. Similarly, he knew while he was in Camp David that a number of his team were very wary of signing a peace treaty with Israel, believing that it would not lead to a solution of the Palestinian question, which is the essence of the Arab quarrel with Israel. But it took the risk, even though his foreign minister in Camp David resigned in Camp David. He signed it. So it is time that Prime Minister Netanyahu took the risk for peace. Continuation of the fighting has a great risk of spread of the war in the Middle East. His determination to stay on in Gaza and also the Philadelphia corridor may prolong the suffering of the Palestinian people. This is the challenge for him to take that risk, which President Anwar Sadat took, even though President Sadat paid a heavy price when he was assassinated because of signing a peace treaty with Israel and producing what was called a cold peace in Egypt. If the Prime Minister of Israel failed to take the risk for peace to resolve a problem where there is an international consensus that it's time for a ceasefire, he's giving the world a negative impression that he does not mind the continuation of the suffering of the Palestinian people and threatening the maintenance of international peace and security.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Yeah. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent. Yaga. Carol, your body necessary. Necessary. Carol, carry new story. New story. Carol, they make my head the turn. Carol, they make me want to lose them. Carol, they make my head the bang. Carol, they make my head the scatter. Carol, your body necessary. Necessary. Carol,
je vais partir le couper, oh. Crosses, most of them not even Christians. Click bang, body sinking at the quicksand. See tech full of bomb like Afghanistan.
And if you make a hike, I mean, no, the enemy, them a plea. I mean, no, they're not sorry for me. People are ball and a skin, cause we bad than we mean. Bloody crime scene, calamity. I saw we shoot out, we and figure Canada G. Make them have a experience, no gravity.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here, the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington.
The Taliban's them I make work. When I laugh up, when I take that. Badness are where we end us. When I shoot people, we end up in a red cross.
No Taliban's like them, near we are sure guns. Make you not sleep at your yard in a 4 months. And so we make people a mourn out. Like y'all get down a house, laugh bars full of key that me sure about. And if you see me travel with a 9X, and no politician with me, I go vote out. 4 kilo, 4 seat, and 4 rounds.
Them on the tea like Lipton, and let the best boom boom, they are Kingston.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Mokbill Yabro and engineer Justin Thwaites, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how sharp a knife is, it can never sharpen its own handle. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
You should I keep in your bed, cause the Taliban's them a make quack. We no laugh, we no take talk. Badness is how we end us. We no show people, we end up in a red grass.